Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome back to the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer, and today I'm joined by Mr. Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
Hi, Nicholas and Mario. So it's a good day, thanks. A seminal day in the history of the West, which I look forward to unpacking with the two of you. Let's see what we can get out of it.
Yeah, don't edit yourself.
Is that called bearing the lead?
Yes, yes. And of course, we also have Mr. Marius Ruett. Marius, how are you, sir?
How's it, guys? Yeah, as Chris says, perhaps the greatest, the most important day in Western history since Romulus and Remus were founded Rome, perhaps.
Oh, dear. Okay, so what are we talking about? Well, we're kind of sarcastically talking a little bit here about Elon Musk is apparently on the verge of succeeding in his bid to buy Twitter for $44 billion, and which he will take the company pretty much entirely private. So this has produced an enormous amount of friction and excitement online. If you go onto Twitter itself, you will see people either claiming that now Twitter will become the greatest bastion of free speech in human history, where every single idea in the marketplace of ideas will be able to flow and wokeness will be dispersed like a cloud. Other people are saying that this is effectively the end of democracy, that Adolf Hitler has assumed power over Germany, and that Elon Musk is going to unleash a tidal wave of misinformation and anti-democratic sentiment. Evidently, I think we can all agree that both of these extremes are quite wrong. But it's an interesting discussion to be had. So Twitter is an interesting platform in the sense that it's relatively small compared to a lot of the other social media platforms. It's overwhelmingly it tends to be, I think it has more of a left-wing bent. I know there was an American study into trying to work out what the political leaning of Twitter would be if it was its own constituency. And the study concluded that it would be, I think, the most left-wing district in the United States. Also, it's relatively small. Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, a lot of these are much bigger platforms that create a lot of influence. Of course, Twitter itself doesn't always produce a huge amount of content, because a lot of what it does is it links to other things. It links to videos from TikTok. It links to articles written on news sites. A lot of the actual content on Twitter tends to be sort of journalists and politicians saying snarky things to each other, which is always a bit weird. But it still manages to hold quite a lot of sway over public debate, particularly in the sort of circles that we run in the sense that the sort of opinionista, thought leader type, yeah, I put in quotation marks, type circles. The kind of people who write opinion pieces, a lot of them are on Twitter, and a lot of it seems to influence the discourse on Twitter, often seems to influence the public discourse through the more traditional mediums, you know, things like blogs and newspapers and substacks and emails and that kind of thing. Very interesting, then, I guess, the role, the reactions that are being provoked by Elon Musk here, by his bid to buy Twitter. It's, I think, a pretty big purchase. I think it may be one of the biggest single purchases of a company going, you know, from publicly traded to private. And to be clear, as far as I understand, while it seems as though the deal is very, very likely to go through at this point, there still could be some technical hitches that throw it off. I don't think ownership has quite been transferred yet. But, Maurice, what do you make of this whole debate? Why is everyone having such strong opinions about this? Do we know yet what Elon Musk is actually going to do with Twitter when he takes it over?
Yeah, I think you're quite right. Nobody knows what Elon Musk is going to do. And there's a little known fact, which perhaps many of our listeners don't know. Elon Musk's full name is Elongated Muskrat. So I just thought to let people know about that. So, but I don't think anybody really knows. But it's also been quite funny to see the kind of meltdown, especially if you're more left-leaning people who claim that they're going to leave Twitter. And, you know, it's the worst, you know, worst thing that's ever happened in human history, that Elon Musk is going to take this over. But I don't think he's going to make it a free-for-all. I'm pretty sure there's still going to be moderation and so on. But it's also quite interesting to see how a lot of people don't have any kind of, what's the word I'm looking for, kind of foundation. I saw Robert Reich, who's former Secretary of Labor in the US, and he's also not really a big fan of Elon Musk. Somebody put two tweets together where one he was saying, when Donald Trump was kicked off Twitter, he was saying, and Trump said he was going to sue Twitter, and Robert Reich said, well, he can't. It's a private company. A private company can do whatever he wants. But now a recent tweet where you were saying Elon Musk can't just go kick whoever he wants off because Twitter is so big now, it is basically the public square. And, you know, you can't have it both ways. Either Twitter is a private company, as more private now than it was before, because now it's going to be literally private. It's not trade on the stock exchange anymore. Either it's a private company and it can kick off whoever it wants and can have any kind of policies it wants, or it is kind of a new public square, which is the kind of the more what I lean towards. So same as Facebook and a lot of these other kind of platforms and so on. And but also, just because something's a public square doesn't mean you can say anything you want. I mean, for example, in Speaker's Corner in London, I'm sure a lot of people have heard of it. You know, they've got a tradition. People can go and give little speeches and talk about what they want. But if you go there and you start saying that, you know, that we should kill all Jews, or, you know, Christians are, you know, should all be thrown for lions, you're not going to be allowed to say that. There's still certain restrictions on what you say, even in the public square. So that's something we still have to take into account. So as you say, Nick, I mean, there's a lot of hot takes, and I don't think everybody knows what's going to happen yet. But it's definitely an interesting time. And I think one of the reasons, as you correctly point out, that Twitter is quite small, actually, compared to Facebook and Instagram and what have you. I think a lot of where Twitter has an advantage is a lot of influential people are on it. So kind of politics or you know, the news or not, the opinion of the day is kind of downstream from Twitter.
A lot of journalists in particular.
Yes, exactly. And, like, you know, a lot of – and people are very active in it. And it kind of lends itself to it. You can – you know, it's the 140-character limit. You come up with these little pithy sayings or thoughts, and, you know, people, you know, it kind of lends itself just to these small little things, but it also doesn't lend itself to nuance. And we've seen that happen in South Africa. I think Helen Zille was a very good example of that, where she said colonialism wasn't all bad, which, whatever you think about it, I don't think saying that on Twitter, that's the kind of thing you need, you know, a 2,000-word think piece. Maybe not even a 2,000-word thing. You actually need to put that kind of thing into a 200-page book, rather.
Chris, what do you make of all this? Why do you think so many people are so enthusiastic about Elon Musk buying Twitter?
Well, I do think, regardless of where we happen to be on the political spectrum, we project our best sort of hopes and ideals onto certain individuals and hope that they will carry that forward and then ignore maybe other things that they've said. I do think, I mean, ultimately Musk is a businessman. He is now, I mean, he's CEO of Tesla, SpaceX, possibly now Twitter as well. Is he maybe going to try for the first little while to fix some of the big issues with Twitter and then get bored of it? I do think he's a pretty good engineer, a technical engineer from that point of view. So maybe he will just focus on those other things and think and realize that maybe progressing humanity will be better achieved by interplanetary travel versus trying to control what people say on a social media platform or sort of make it a better place in which to interact. I don't think he's the messiah, savior of free speech. I just hope that maybe some people now, especially on the right, more see the importance of things like Section 230. In the US, especially in terms of keeping spaces private, and that you might disagree with what is being said there, but at least
just explain what Section 230 is quickly.
Yeah, so Section 230 of the, I don't remember which act it is exactly, but in the US, it provides for certain protections and freedom from liability in a way from comments that are said. So if it's a newspaper, for example, you write a letter to a newspaper, then you're liable for that, but the editor of the newspaper isn't, you know, necessarily liable for it. So the same sort of idea on Twitter. Yes, this thing of it's become big and it's a quote unquote public space, public square, but it's still a private company. It's still private property. So yes, I'm going to disagree with someone practicing their religion on their private property, but that doesn't mean I should use the state to seize that property and shape it into a way with which I agree. So I think the same thing should apply for something like Twitter. Now that someone who ostensibly might be more for more robust free speech has taken control of the company, those protections should remain in place. So we should realize that your opponents, your political opponents, they can always use the power and the levers of the state against you. So you should always ensure that that scope of action is as limited as possible against private companies. Otherwise, they can then use it in future in different, as Marius pointed out with Robert Reich, who very quickly switched now that Musk has taken over. It's also interesting, I mean, for people on the left generally, how they're projecting their worst fears onto Musk. I don't think he's a robust libertarian in a principled sense. I think he knows which buttons to press and how to get interest going. I have in mind now, you know, will he now invite back people and accounts that were banned? And in that vein, I sort of see that meme, the two Spider-Men pointing to each other, and I see him and Donald Trump, and like who can come up with the most like sensationalist take and who wants the most attention? I mean, he might say, we'll open it up for people who are banned and you can come and appeal that decision. That puts it in the ball in their court kind of thing, instead of just saying we'll unban everyone. So let's see how it shakes out. I think it's going to take at least 6 to 7 months before we see any real changes. One of the biggest hopes from my point of view is maybe opening up some of the algorithms, which would be quite interesting to just see how things work, and spam accounts and that sort of thing. So let's see how it works. But yeah, at this point in time, it's not the end of the world for either side, I don't think.
Yeah, so this is Elon's been pretty vague, I think, about some of the things he wants to do so far, or at least, you know, the devil's in the details, I think, of some of the suggestions. So, of course, he's talked about enhancing it as a platform for free speech. What does that mean? Because no one really agrees on what free speech actually is. We have a vague idea of it, but, you know, his idea of free speech could be different to yours or mine. Also, of course, we have this promise to end spam bots, to authenticate all human users. And I also think there's been some mention of making the algorithm by which Twitter promotes tweets open source, so people can sort of see how that works. That, I think, is the most concrete thing he said, and that's a very interesting idea. It'd be very interesting just to see kind of what's going on behind the scenes. You know, how much does Twitter actually manipulate things in terms of what you see in your feeds? What is it kind of prioritize? That stuff is all going to be interesting if he makes that public. Although he might not, because that might allow a competitor to pop up. And this is one of the things that's been discussed now, is there's sort of people who think that Elon Musk will not drive the platform in a good way, and so they're threatening to start their own platform. Now, we've seen right-wing versions of this. Donald Trump attempted to start one called Truth, which we talked a little bit ago on the show. It appears to have failed on launch. As far as I know, it hasn't made a huge impact. It's got some tech problems. A lot of people who put themselves on a waiting list to download it weren't able to get on accounts. So, Marius, do you think we're going to see like a left-wing version of Twitter now that is going to pop up and also burn out? Or do you think that there might be some actual competition to Twitter, at least in the specific kind of thing that Twitter does, which is microblogging? I think it's the cool kids term.
Yeah, I think we'll probably see some of these things pop up, just as you said, with these right-wing versions, Gab and Getter and whatever. They shouldn't have the momentum. They shouldn't have the money behind it. So I think it's going to be very hard for Twitter to be overtaken. I think if it does, it'll be something we don't really expect at the moment. Remember, I mean, 15 years ago, whatever, or maybe 18 years ago, MySpace was the big thing. And then MySpace went away, and then Facebook came along, and Facebook is also starting to lose users. So, you know, in 10 or 15 years' time, Twitter and Facebook might be gone, but there'll be some other kind of social media thing that we can't even think of at the moment that'll come to the fore. So I do hope that the algorithms in Twitter do get fixed, just as in a personal aside, I remember once a tweet came up on my feed saying, you might like this. And it was basically a tweet saying, me and Harriman Pretorius, our colleague, were two of the worst people that this user had ever come across. So it wasn't really something like, no, I won't like that, but thanks.
You know? I don't know, Morris, maybe you have a masochistic streak.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't even, I mean, there's not even somebody I'd interacted with before. It's just like, you might like this, saying me and Harriman are terrible people. Like, thanks, no, not really. So, but just a final note, though. I mean, I think there's lots to criticize Elon Musk about, but I think he's going to be somebody that we're going to be talking about in 100 or 150 years. You know, he's going to be a Thomas Edison or Henry Ford or whatever. And also what I like about him, he's a big thinker, you know. Like, you can say the stuff about going to Mars is all pie in the sky, but somebody needs to be thinking about that kind of thing. And, you know, I'm quite like sci-fi and this kind of thing. So, you know, it's kind of, yeah, it makes you quite excited to think about humans eventually being on Mars and there being permanent colonies there. But as I said, it's something we need to think about. And, you know, I think Musk does think on these long timelines. He doesn't really, you know, he's not a He's not just thinking what's going to happen at the next shareholders meeting. He's going to think what's going to be happening to humanity in 200, 500, or even 1,000 years' time. And I think we actually do need somebody like that thinking about that.
Yeah, so I want to agree with you completely on that point. You know, I don't really like Musk's style. That's just a kind of personal thing. But I really like the fact that he embraces the eccentric billionaire and spends his money on crazy things, like, you know, going to Mars and buying a social media platform and stuff. And yeah, let's see what he does with Twitter. I don't think Twitter is a great platform at the moment for public discourse. I think it has some negative effects. So I don't really see how he could make it worse. In fact, he probably can only make it better. But I don't know. Maybe we'll completely change our minds in a year from now. But I think that this is ultimately not going to be that big of a deal, despite all the sound and fury that has been produced on it. Anyway, let us move on to our next.
I just want to give Renier Dievenhager from AfriForum a shout out on this one. He mentioned today, of course, that he and Elon Musk both grew up in Pretoria, and since then they have gone on to accumulate 264.6 billion net worth between them. So there we go. Credit to Renier. You guys are doing well.
No, exactly. It's a great joke. All right. So let's go on to our next one. And we did talk a little bit about this yesterday with its the ANC's specific supposed course change on land reform, switching to kind of shy away from expropriation and move towards something more along the lines of private donations from companies and farmers and that kind of thing. But as part of the same document that has been kind of boosted by the Sunday Times, we expressed some skepticism. There's also claims that the ANC is generally seems to be moving in favor of something where the private sector takes far more of a role in South Africa's economy. This is a draft policy document, which the Sunday Times got a hold of. And it basically says that there are going to be steps to boost exploration for gas, green metals, nickel, vanadium, copper, cobalt, platinum. The government should work with the private sector to implement at least 10 high-impact infrastructure projects in 2022 to 2023. The support for the creation of green hydrogen and electric vehicle industries. Maybe Elon Musk would be interested in that. and just generally a sort of more public-private partnership approach to the economy. To people like us, on the surface, this sounds like it's got some good ideas that we'd encourage, but I don't know. We were skeptical about the land reform thing today, about the larger objectives of this policy document. Chris, should we take them too seriously?
It might be useful in terms of driving a wedge if we see others within the party sounding similar notes, but as a fundamental issue, I don't think it really points to meaningful change. It's sort of like, yeah, the best example I can think of is now the supposed reform with Transnet and the railways, where only the most lucrative routes will be put up for sort of auction, but it's all the lines and all the investment, everything is still going to be owned by Transnet. So now with, I don't know, energy or other sectors, there'll be more private participation allowed and more quote unquote competition, but it's still on the same train track owned by the ruling party. So they can take it away at any time. There's no actual incentive to invest long-term, no real capital formation and investment, all of that sort of thing. I think it's more material. It doesn't indicate really government giving up fundamental control of certain sectors of the economy. And that's for as long as we don't head in any sort of direction, that kind of direction, then you won't see substantive growth. I don't think it's more tinkering at the margins and trying to sell people through smoke and mirrors and that sort of thing. So this will be very appealing to those who sold themselves and put a lot of their reputations on President Ramaphosa as the great reformer, as the great next hope, because now, look, he's trying, and that's why he needs to win again at the next ANC conference so that he can really cement his position and reform from the inside and all that sort of stuff. But it doesn't really radically show an ideological shift, I don't think, away from what has gone before. There won't be, I don't know, the ANC, for example, won't put out a statement saying we repudiate and, you know, completely move away from expropriation without compensation. It's just another way to try and get there. So it's trying, I think, to put things in different terms and still get what they want at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I must say, I can also see an a case where this sort of goes forward, but it's not in the way that we'd be particularly happy with. So there's this old phrase that was very popular in the 30s called corporatism, which the fascists in Italy were very keen on. And this is basically where the state and the sort of corporations kind of merge together. That doesn't mean that the corporations take over the state, that in this case, you know, big businesses start running the country, but rather that their interests become sort of so aligned that, you know, essentially what you have is you pass the SOE from the government over to a very closely state-linked ANC-affiliated company, and it just continues to run it in pretty much as a patronage machine, but maybe with a tiny bit more efficiency. And that's not a great solution either. That's not really a free market reform. Maurice, what do you make of this?
Well, you know, I think generally I agree with you guys, but maybe this is, you know, and this reformist wing that we've been told about that exists under Ramaphosa, which I think is pretty much, it's a unicorn, because I think it's something that's, you know, it's mythical and doesn't really exist. But maybe if it does exist, this is them starting to float these ideas of more private sector involvement in the economy. What we've seen happens with the ANC, they often, you know, put forward quite a crazy idea. They'll say, you know, we're going to cut everybody's left arms off. And everybody's like, no, you're crazy. They're like, oh, sorry. We'll just cut everybody's left pinkies off. And everybody's like, oh, okay, geez, that's much better. That, you know, that's much more reasonable. And I think that's often happened with a lot of the more socialist policies of the party. But maybe this is what, as I say, we're starting to see the, you know, more reformist wing. Maybe it's finally making a breakthrough. I mean, I'm a bit cynical. I don't really think that. But, you know, just to play devil's advocate, maybe that's what it is. But I think you guys are quite right. There's no, I don't really see this as being any real move to reform. But on the issue of, say, for example, the five companies using the railway lines, we have seen in South Africa there has been some quite successful public-private partnerships. I think Gautrain is an example. I think a lot of the toll roads around the country have been pretty successful. So maybe, you know, there's a template for this thing to work. But, I mean, as we've seen, the ANC, I've said it before on the show, the ANC is pretty much the reverse of King Midas. So instead of everything they touch turn into gold, you know. But, yeah, so, but you know, like, yeah, maybe I'm clutching at straws here, but maybe this is a green shoot we've been waiting for. But I'm not, you know, I think we have to wait a while before we can say with any certainty.
Indeed. All right, let's move on to our next topic. And once again, we are going overseas to talk about France. So I think we missed talking about this on the show yesterday, but France had the second round on Sunday of their presidential election. And the first round saw current incumbent president Emmanuel Macron win the highest share of the votes. And Marine Le Pen came in second. And because of France's electoral system, that means the top two people in the candidates in the first round then go through to face off in the second round. And Macron won a victory, which was, I think, a little bit better than what some of the polls had suggested, but also quite a bit down from where people thought he might be when he headed into re-election. So Macron managed to become, I think, the first French president to get re-elected in 30 years, which says something about the craziness of French politics, right? That they haven't been very good at re-electing their presidents. He won about 58% of the vote, to Marine Le Pen, sort of 41 or so. And this is in comparison to the last time they ran up against each other, which was in the last election. It was the same two candidates in the final round, where he, I think, won 2/3 of the votes. Marine Le Pen was only around 1/3. So at least an 8-point gain for Marine Le Pen, which he is probably happy with. But it's been a kind of interesting election. So, Maurice, I'm going to get your thoughts on it in a second here. But the impression I got about this is that Marine Le Pen, in contrast to how the English press talked about her as, you know, being focused on immigration and her relationship with Russia and things like that, she focused very much on cost of living issues and actually moved quite a lot to the left on a lot of economic issues. And that seems to have been maybe what won her a lot of support from the socialist candidate, Mélenchon, who came in third. What's your take on this election, Maurice?
Yeah, I think that's it. I think she was also helped by the Eric Zemmour, who's, you know, even more to the left than Marine Le Pen. So that kind of softened Marine Le Pen's image, even though she was quite right-wing on, you know, the rights of Muslims and so on. I think, for a lot of people comparing her to Eric Zemmour. They're like, no, she's not that bad. Maybe I could actually vote for her. But I think that's something that also should be raised is that her father ran for, he was a perennial candidate, and he actually also made the second round in 2002 versus Jacques Chirac. But in that election, his name was Jean-Marie, I think. He won less than 20% of the vote, and with Jacques Chirac winning over 80% of the votes in the second round. So it shows you how she's more than doubled the votes up to 2022. So I think it shows that, you know, this it's probably not far off. I mean, the kind of right-wing candidates, they're within touching distance of the French presidency at the moment. And who knows, if there hadn't been the war in Ukraine, maybe they wouldn't have been able to tie with the, you know, the kind of Putin brush. And I think maybe that turned off a lot of people from voting for her. She's seen as being an ally of Putin, and the Russians decided, no, they don't want to vote for, or turned off from voting altogether. But I think what's going to be something to watch is the legislative election, which is beginning of June. And at the moment, Macron's party holds about 60% of the seats in parliament. So he's been able to do quite a lot while he's been president, because he's obviously been president and had quite a big majority in the French parliament. So he'll obviously be hoping that he can carry holding on to this kind of thing. But it remains to be seen. But as you mentioned, Mélenchon, the guy who came third, he's also a far left candidate. He seems to think he could maybe even be prime minister of the after the election coming up in June. So there'll be quite interesting Macron presidency with a Mélenchon being prime minister. Kind of, Macron's pretty centrist in most things, and then we have this hard left guy. But I think also what we've seen now, it's a phenomenon that's been happening across Europe, but I think France is kind of the epitome of it, where the old parties, the old centre-right and old centre-left parties, which kind of just alternated power, that doesn't happen anymore. And I think, as I say, France is the epitome of it. The old right-wing, the old centre-right and the old centre-left parties, they both got completely annihilated in the presidential election. And it'll be interesting to see what happens in the parliamentary election in June.
Le Pen picked up support in the sort of old Rust Belt type areas of France, on the border with Belgium and Germany, as well as kind of maintaining her support in the south of France, which is traditionally the sort of far right's base of support, with Macron doing very well in Paris and in the west of the country. Chris, any thoughts on the selection?
Yeah, maybe just useful to point to some of the bigger concerns that are going to be prevalent on most politicians, especially in the Western world over the next few years, with, I think, inflation continuing to increase because of stimulus. I mean, that's the biggest issue. I think that it's easy. They'll point to Putin, the invasion of Ukraine. It'll be easier for European politicians to get away with that versus Americans blaming supply chain issues for inflation. But still, you can't just keep on blaming external factors when your own government just keeps on devaluing currencies by printing more and more of them and not actually allowing reforms in terms of economic growth to happen. Sort of interesting to see how that is handled by politicians across the spectrum, if indeed one considers there to be a spectrum still. If you move far enough to the left or the right, you end up having the same sort of statist policies, I would argue. But it'll be interesting how that's sort of couched and termed, at least. Yeah, so I think maybe for a lot of pollsters, at least they'll feel a bit better after this, because they would have predicted a win for Macron. And after what happened with Trump and Brexit, they would have worried about their models and all that sort of stuff. But let's see what happens with France going forward. They'll also be able to ride a bit some goodwill and some boosts from hosting the World Cup and the Olympics over the next few years. Maybe that'll give them some momentum, specifically in Europe, sort of lead the charge, as it were. But yeah, let's see what happens.
Indeed. Of course, Le Pen is quite young still. She's sort of in her 50s, so she's very likely to be able to sort of have the energy to drive for another re-election bid next time. And then Macron's term will be finished, because I think there's a two-term limit in France, in which case, who knows? Maybe it'll finally be the year that Le Pen happens. but this is, I think, her third rodeo, and she's not managed to get there quite yet. So I don't know. I'm still a little bit skeptical of the idea that she will ever be president of France. But anyway, that is all the time we have for today. Thank you very much for watching the show. Please like the show. Please subscribe to it on YouTube. Please leave us reviews on the podcast apps. and share it with your friends. Anyway, tomorrow is Freedom Day, so we hope that you enjoy the holiday, and we will see you again on Thursday for another episode of the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.